My name is Clancy Immerslin, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here this morning. Glad to be here for this nice occasion. 20th birthday is a big deal. Decimal birthdays are always a big deal. Oddly enough, in sobriety, decimal birthdays are always followed by little depressions, as a rule. Because you work yourself up to 5 years. I'm 5 years sober, and nothing changes. A lot of people have difficulty after 5 years, after 1 year. But after 20 years, you've handled it pretty well. And I guess I want to thank John for the nice things he said. He's kindly. I was going to thank the other two girls, too, but I guess they went home. They heard what they came to hear. I know they're sitting back there, but I don't want to pay any attention to them. I guess I'm getting to be kind of a sentimentalist. You know, I've been sober a long time, and they say you get soft. I try not to, but I am soft. This morning I was thinking, if I had one day left to live, I think I'd really try to get here to Billings, and I'd like to hear the history of the group, of the AA group, and the Al-Anon group. It would make that last day seem like forever. But seriously, what John was saying, the things about you thank people for, that's certainly true. It's so easy to take things for granted around here. We forget that everybody here is a miracle. It's so corny to say that, and I hate to even say it, but it's so true. Once it just grabs you once in a while, my God, what the hell are we all doing here? Especially when you think the nature of what we got. You know, there seem to be types of alcoholics. Nobody ever talks about it much, but there seems to be types of alcoholics. There's a type of alcoholic who seems to be an alcoholic by any way you measure them. They drink and get in trouble, have problems. And something happens that really threatens their security. Maybe they lose a job. Maybe they lose a family. Maybe somebody dies. And they quit. And they never drink again. There's a lot of people like this floating around. And the same type of alcoholic, if they have become addicted to alcohol, you don't hear much about that either. But alcoholic addiction, physical addiction, is worse than drug addiction. We hear about drug addiction, how sad it all is. People die in withdrawal from alcohol addiction. They die in convulsions and smashing your head to the sidewalk and terrible things. Drug addicts get very sick. Alcoholics die. These are the people for whom treatment centers were originally created, to withdraw people medically from addiction. And each step of the way, they showed them this type of alcoholic. They go through that, and they come out of that treatment center, and they have tears of sincerity rolling down their cheeks, and they quit. And they never drink again. In Seattle, a very big hospital, as most of you know, called Schick Shadel, they advertise to alcoholics, "We will cure your alcoholism in 30 days and 2 follow-up visits." And we laugh, say, "That's ridiculous." But they have a long list of names, people who swear by, "They saved me." That's one type of alcoholic. This is another type of alcoholic who seems to be an alcoholic by any way you measure them. They drink and can't stop and get in trouble. And something happens that really threatens their security. They lose a job, they lose a family, somebody dies, and they quit. But they always eventually drink again. And these same type of people come out of treatment centers with tears of sobriety, tears of sincerity rolling down their cheeks. And they quit. But they always eventually drink again. And these are the type of alcoholics that have puzzled humanity for 4,000 years in written history. Just what's wrong with these people? They just seem not cared. One time they thought they were possessed by devils. They were put to death and flogged and sent away. And even in my lifetime, and I'm old, but I'm not 4,000 years old. But in my life, when I was a little boy growing up in Wisconsin in snow, very similar to this, and thank God I got out of it. I have 2 toes that are still thawing from 1949. Anyway. But when I was a little boy, they still had no answer for people like this anywhere in the world. They had some cures, the Keeley cure, where they'd make them sick on drinking, put stuff in their booze. They'd get sick and quit until they found a bar where they didn't put stuff in their booze, you know. They've had all sorts of treatments. And even since I've been sober, it's been kind of funny. I've been watching various people trying to find a way to stop like those other people do. When I was about 2 years sober, 3 years sober, I was working in a medical corporation. I was writing ads for a product they had, but I'd get the medical magazines, and I saw the first ad ever heard of, designed aimed at doctors for treatment of alcoholics. It said, "Doctors, at last you can treat your alcoholics without fear of side effects and in absolute secrecy, and they work out fine." And I read that, God, I just missed that by a little bit, too. And I had the name of it was so wonderful, it was called Librium. That meant freedom. Oh, man. Then about a year later, the first Librium returnees start coming back. And I want to get my medallion tonight if I can find the podium. Then I went to work in television. I was working in television in Hollywood in Schick-Schedel had a new plan. They could return alcoholics to social drinking. It was something to do with an imbalance of their metabolism somehow. How I came upon it, I heard something about it, and then I saw in our schedule for the day, they had a spokesman from Sheikh Shadell who's going to do a public information program showing how alcoholics should drink. And so I went down and stood behind the camera. I wanted to see this. And this guy said, "I'm a known alcoholic. I've been in trouble many times. I'm now the director of the program there. They say that alcoholics can't drink. But if you redress this metabolism, you can drink." And he had a martini. And he picked it up and drank it. And I didn't even want it, but my tongue went. I thought, Jesus, I wonder if 7-Eleven has any metabolism redressers just for that. But then about a year later, or 6 months later, I guess I heard through the grapevine that I guess one day his metabolism redresser hadn't kicked in and he was in a padded cell in Seattle now, so they changed their song back to abstinence. And one of my all-time favorites was about 1968, a big Seventh-day Adventist hospital outside of Los Angeles. Seventh-day Adventists are deadly on drinking. They'd have no use for drinking. But they realize it exists. And so what they'd done, at the White Memorial Hospital, their hospital, they'd taken one big ward and turned it into a bar, with a regular bar, with a back bar, with a railing, glasses. I mean, and these poor guys come in the first day. Bar says, "Well, want a little drink, partner? We're going to give me some dope in the drink that makes you sick?" "Not at all. I guarantee you this is the stuff just in the bar." "Okay, I'll try it." You give them a drink, you give them a little glass with a little cord on it, I guess, so they wouldn't steal it. And boy, you Seventh-day Adventists know how to treat alcoholics. And this is one for 2, 3, 4 days. The guy would be doing, just couldn't wait to get down in the morning. And one day he'd be down there and get his drink, and they'd shoot an electric shock through that cord. Hold the ice next time, Fred. Then they give him a drink without a shock. Thanks. Then he came back the next morning and get a shock. Then he wouldn't get a shock. Then after all, these guys would come in. "Here's a drink." Finally, the daycare, they said, "You want a drink?" "No, I don't believe I do." And if you do that for 3 days, they knew he was cured, and they released him. They ran a full-page article in the Los Angeles Times about this new treatment of alcoholism. And about 2 years later, somebody finally did a follow-up on them. They're all drunk. Most of them had never got beyond the first bar that had glasses without cords on, you know. But all of a sudden, and keeps on and on. There are always new answers. We found the X factor in the chromosome that makes an alcoholic, which turned out to be baloney. Nobody has any idea what causes alcoholics of this type or why. It certainly isn't a lack of will. Some alcoholics of this type in every level of society, in every job you could do. What makes them that way? Nobody knows. And these are the type of people that die from alcoholism or live with great pain. You might think, well, you don't have to die from alcoholism anymore. There's AA everywhere. That's true in America. Probably there isn't a city with a stoplight that doesn't have an AA meeting now. And it's all over. And freight, and on the West Coast, we are in the heart of it. I would say Southern California probably is really the heart of it, because there's more sober alcoholics south of Santa Barbara than in New York and Illinois combined. But it really is, but it's great center here, pocket of enthusiasm. And you might think that, isn't the center of AA, isn't the heart of AA really Akron? I'll tell you, Akron has the same relationship to AA that Bethlehem has to Christianity. Something nice happened there once, but not for a long time. It's really out here. But it's no longer necessary to die for alcoholism. We're not us fine. And yet, according to the latest figure from the National Institute of Health, the ones I saw were, I guess, 2004, it is estimated that of alcoholics of our type in America, something over 90% of us still die drunk, or is a direct result of alcohol in one form or another. And you think, why would that be, for God's sakes? It's not necessary. And that's the nature of the disease of alcoholism. It makes it so baffling, because it's the only disease I know of where the main symptom is the victim denying its existence. And so they come to places like AA, and AA had more success. There are more people sober in this room than there were in the world in 1938, you know. But yet we just take it for so what. But there are, AA now has been most successful. But as with all things in decimal years, somebody's got to do some decimal year. In 2005, I mean, in the International Convention in Toronto, and a couple of years before that, it started in 2000 in Minneapolis. We're at a stage now where Alcoholics Anonymous has to change. It has to keep up with society. And there were three or four things that seemed to be festering in various parts of the area, the world. One is, of course, that we really are doing ourselves a disservice by insisting you be an alcoholic to be an AA. So many young people today are on drugs. And that's all they know, and they're desperate. They have no place to go. And when we say you can't come today and participate, we do that. That is absolutely wrong, and some groups do it. They say you can come in. But this idea of being so defiantly against everything except alcohol is very egotistical. Another one is that we really should update the book. It's a great book. But it's kind of written in 1930s vernacular and jargon, and people don't identify with it much. It's not they identify, but it's kind of like reading a history book almost. Then there's a school of thought that feels we should do away with the Lord's Prayer, and that's really more active than you think. Now, you don't feel it here at all, and you don't feel it in our group at all, but there are vast places in America where they won't say the Lord's Prayer, and they won't say it overseas. All the groups in Australia, two groups say the Lord's Prayer. Of all the groups in New Zealand, one group says the Lord's Prayer. You can travel through England and Ireland, and nobody says the Lord's Prayer. They all say the Serenity Prayer, because the Lord's Prayer is too religious, and they shouldn't have a religious prayer because it keeps people who are not Christians out of AA. It's too Christian. Then there's a group of thought that talks about, we are not doctors here. We shouldn't be people telling people what medications they can take or can't take. That is up to them and their doctor. And we do a disservice to ourselves and to everyone else when we risk their lives when we tell them about medication. And finally, the last thing that I hear about is anonymity. It was good at one time to protect people. We don't need it anymore. If only some people in the world out there knew what kind of people there were, some people in AA, they would just draw them in just to see those people. Just come here and see. It's not a bunch of guys in black overcoats sitting around sucking at a bottle of wine. It's really something dramatic. And each of these ideas have strong proponents, and their arguments are pretty good. And so you have to just think about it a little bit. Why, of all things, should AA today insist that you be an alcoholic to be an Alcoholics Anonymous? Isn't that just a bit much? Then you have to go back and get the concept of that alcoholism, that type of alcoholism, that type where they never can stop. They must always drink again. And at the beginning of there were two movements in the history. One was the Washingtonians in 1840, where some drunks got together to try to help each other. And in 5 years, they'd enlarged to 100,000 sober drunks. And they got together then and thought, we really shouldn't be confining ourselves to drunkards. There's so many people have problems, narcotics addicts, not heroin and cocaine like today, but opium and laudanum, and we should get involved in politics, and we should stamp out the sale of a lot of things. And by 1848, the movement was gone, and they were all drunk. And Bill had never heard of it until somebody wrote it to him about the 1950s. And then there's this other movement that we're in now. Now, why should you have to be an alcoholic? And it boils down to this. Each of us, every alcoholic that I've known of our type, and perhaps I'm wrong, but I think, come here knowing one thing. I may know I'm desperate. I may know I need help badly. I may know a lot of things. But I secretly know that my case is different. You don't understand. And unless that can be overcome, I must always drink again, sooner or later, but at least to ameliorate it, cut it down. And what has made AA, well, Bill Wilson got a spiritual awakening in the middle of the night. And he says that's, at first they thought that's what you had to do. When the book was written, the first printing of the book, if you look into the 12 steps, it said 12 step, having had a spiritual experience as a result of this. A spiritual experience. You had to have a spiritual experience like Bill Wilson had. And after the book came out, they realized, Jesus, his followers, we didn't have a spiritual experience. We didn't have any wind blowing through our heads with a light, you know. When are we going to get ours? And they came to realize that that is not exactly correct. That most of us, nearly all of us, get it on an evolutionary thing. Little by little. Not the way Bill Wilson got his. Whoom! But the way we get ours. You want me to make amends to that bitch? And bring the result much slower. So the next printing of the book, they changed it to what it reads today, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. But Bill Wilson had the spiritual awakening, and he associated with the Oxford group. You all know that story, I'm sure, that a guy went to a very wealthy man, very wealthy family, had a drinking problem. Whenever he got nervous, it seemed he drank too much, and his family was concerned. So they found the best psychiatrist in the world to treat him. And they contacted this great psychiatrist, Dr. Freud. And Dr. Freud refused to take the case. That was the first break we ever got anywhere. We'd all be sitting here today drunk and saying, well, I dreamt I was sober. So they went to his ex-colleague, Dr. Jung, and we all know that story. The guy went there and Dr. Jung put him in a sanitarium there in Switzerland and worked with him every day to break through the walls of his psyche to get to the inner ego and to work it out. And finally got him all set. He understood the nature of his problem. Said, Roland, you can go home now. You're set. Roland got as far as Paris, and some friends of his family, wealthy folks, invited him over to a celebratory luncheon. And they all toasted him with a glass of wine, and he joined in. And 3 days later, he was face down drunk again. They couldn't understand why, because he was supposed to be cured. They sent him back to Dr. Jung, and Dr. Jung refused to take him back, which shocked everybody. He didn't mean to be bad. He's a nice man. He said, I know that, but I now realize I've misdiagnosed his case. He does not have the psychoneurotic problem I thought he had. He is what is known as a compulsive alcoholic. And to the best of my knowledge, there is no treatment for that condition anywhere in the world at any cost. And this was 1931, not all that long ago. And Roland says, Jesus, doctor, what does that mean? He says, Roland, it means that you must keep yourself confined voluntarily or involuntarily as long as you live. Otherwise, you almost certainly will intermittently drink until you die or go mad. He says, is there anything else at all? He said, well, in a few cases in the literature, there's been some sort of a spiritual phenomenon, they call it a spiritual experience, of involuntary relocation of emotional reaction. He said, I've never seen one. I read about it, but I wouldn't think you could count on that. And so he came home, and he didn't stop in Paris this time. And he got back, and he was already a vestryman in the Presbyterian Church, and he'd been a good man. And what could he do to get the spiritual... So we went, at that time, there's something called the Oxford Movement, which was kind of a high-grade religious movement where well-to-do people got together and discussed spiritual values. And he went to one of those and he stayed sober. And he always thought it was due to the Oxford movement, but it probably wasn't. And after about 6 months, a year, his family was so pleased with him. Oh, Roland, you're taking your place back in the business. Why don't you take a vacation? And every summer, when he was a boy, they used to go up to Vermont. So he said, go up to our home in Vermont, spend some time. And he went up there. And the irony is this. If he'd gone a week later, we wouldn't be here. Because the week he got here, some of his friends come up and said, oh, you know, this kid you used to run around with, used to drink with, Ebby, he's in bad trouble. Could you talk to him? He said, sure, I'll try to talk to him. So Ebby came over and he tried to talk about the Oxford group and you try to find a belief in God. And Ebby said, I don't want to hear that stuff. Come on. Come on, Roland. You're goofy. And a few days later, they came back and said, well, Ebby's been arrested now. He ran, got drunk, ran his car into somebody's house. He's been on severe probation. They're now going to give him 10 years in the penitentiary. Could you come over and talk to the judge? You know the judge. You and your dad know the judge. And the kid says, my dad is the judge, and I can't help him. But maybe you can. So we went over and talked to him. Said, you know, I used to drink too, Your Honor. And you know my family. I haven't had a drink for a long time. And I think there's an answer. If I could only get Ebby to New York to the Oxford movement. The judge says, okay, I will release him to you to go to New York. But if he comes back to Vermont, he's going to the penitentiary. So he took him to New York and put him in a mission on Broadway. And he went to the Oxford movement, and he didn't much like it at first, but he did pretty well, all in all. He got to start to feel a little bit better. He thought, maybe there's some hope. And then one day, one of the things about the Oxford movement, you had to testify to somebody eventually. And so Roland says, okay, Ebby, it's time to testify. He says, I don't want to testify. That's humiliating, embarrassing. Well, do you want to go back to Vermont? No. I think I'll testify. So he decided to testify. But who could he testify? He wanted to testify to someone where it wouldn't embarrass him. And he had to remember his childhood friend from Vermont, who was even worse off than he was, living off his wife, a drunken bum, a scum. And he knew he was somewhere in Brooklyn or New York, so he looked him up, got this guy, Bill Wilson, and called him up and said, I'd like to come over and talk to you, Bill. He said, sure, it was nice to hear from you, Abby. And then we came over to go on the first part of the book. We talk about that, how Bill's reaction came to the door, and here's this clean, sober, sharp guy, Ebby. And he said, how are you doing so well? He said, I found religion. He said, oh, damn it. But I heard Ebby talk 40 years ago, and he added a little more to the story. He 45 years ago, he added a little more to the story. He said, they went in and sat down, and he tried to tell Bill about the Oxford group, and Bill just kept drinking. That's really wonderful, Ebby. Wish you well. And he left, and he was kind of upset. He had to be put down by this drunken puke. So although Bill doesn't mention in our book, he came back 2 days later with the Oxford group closer with him. Hi, Mr. Wilson, I want to talk about the Oxford group. And Bill reacted as I hope any one of us would. Want one of the damnedest drunks of his life. There's for you in the Oxford group, you know. And he's going to go over to see Ebby in the mission on Broadway, and he got drunk on the way, and by the time he got to the mission, he was drunk, and Ebby wasn't there, but he gave a short sermon anyway, and continued on down the street. And not very long afterwards, he was back in Towns Hospital again, a hopeless case. And this time, the doctor called him, his wife, and said, you know, Mrs. Wilson, your husband doesn't have many left. This may be his last one he's got in him. If he goes again, we don't know what's going to happen. And he's on the edge of death. And she, oh, my God. And she remembered Bill had told her about Ebby, so she called up Ebby at the mission and said, could you go talk to Bill? He might be dying. So then up there, the couple guys said, you know, Bill, you've got to find a power grid in yourself. You know, I don't want to hear that religious crap. God, I know all about it. They went home. In the middle of the night, this guy just had no merit, didn't earn anything such nice at all. But he suddenly woke up in the middle of the night and he cried out, if there's a God, show yourself. And he says, he wrote later, it's almost he saw a light in the room. And like a wind blew. And he said, my God, I'm going crazy. I'm out of my head. The next morning, he told the doctor about it. He said, doctor, you think I'm insane? I said, I don't know. You're not insane, Bill. You've had some kind of experience I'm not familiar with, but you better hang on to it. Right? And a couple of days later, he got out of the hospital, and he went to the Oxford group. And which is a fortunate thing, because most people, when the very, very few people ever had those spiritual experiences, went into religion. They associated with the religion. But he associated with Ebby in the Oxford group. And he went over there, and he thought he had a mandate to help alcoholics, this Bill Wilson. And day after day, he would go out and find street people and bring them to the Oxford group meetings and take them home. I mean, you can imagine, these are fine, upper-scale people. And he'd find some old rummy street drunk and bring them in. I believe you're vomiting on my shoe. Once in a while, you take him home. And this was around month after month. His wife was working. He couldn't get a job. And one morning, after about 6 months, he got up in the morning. The guy he had brought home the night before apparently had decamped and stolen some stuff out of the kitchen to sell for wine. He watched his wife, who once upon a time been a pert, chic young society girl, putting on her old sweater with a patch on the sleeve, looking old before her time, gray, so she could go to work in this cheap department store and support him to help these boobs that wouldn't even stay sober. And he had a blinding flash. He said, "But, Ann," he said to his wife, no, Ann was Dr. Bob's wife, he said, "I've made a terrible mistake. I thought I could help alcoholics and drinkers, but I can't. I've preached to these guys. They always preach to them about religion and God. So I can't help these people. And I've wasted my time, and I've wasted your time. And I'm going to stop doing it, and I'm going to get a job, and I'm not going to do all this stuff anymore. It's just ridiculous. It doesn't. Lois, I'm sorry, it's going to be better." And right there, my friends, your life and mine hung by a thread so thin you can't even measure it. And she turned and said something to him that changed the course of history. I was having lunch with her a long time ago in Connecticut. I said, "Lois, how'd you ever think of that? God, you just changed the course of history." She said, "I don't know. It didn't seem that much to me. I just told him something he didn't know." Because what he had said was, "I've been working with people for 6 months and not one person stayed sober." And she said, "You did." "Oh, yeah." That's why old timers don't have much hair in front. You go through life with So he tried to do it again, but he went to talk to Dr. Towns about it. Dr. Towns said, "Bill, the reason you're not succeeding because you're preaching to these guys. You got to explain to them that you know how they feel. You got to help them understand that you've been where they've been. You've got to identify, make some identification if you can." He said, "Oh, I never thought of that." And he got a little job then to go out to Akron, Ohio. We all know that story. The job blew up and he met this doctor and he went into a room with him. The doctor didn't want to spend any time with him at all. But came out 4 hours later. His doctor said to his wife, "Ann, I just heard, first person I ever met that knew how I feel." And he said, Bill was in kind of bad shape. He had $10 in his pocket. He either could pay his hotel bill or he could take a train home. And he said, "Bill, I hate to ask you this, but could you stay with us for a couple of weeks and live at our house? We can talk." I said, "Let's see. I've nowhere to get out of town." "Yes, I can do that." And so we stayed with him, and for 2 weeks they talked about spiritual matters and the Oxford group and deep understandings. And the doctor was so pleased that he said, "I'm going to go to the American Medical Association Convention in Atlantic City. I went last year, got so drunk they ridiculed me, but this year I'm going to go sober. You stay here with my wife and a couple of kids, and I'll be back Sunday night or Monday morning." And away he went. Monday morning, got a phone call. It was Dr. Bob's office nurse. "So, Mrs. Smith, I'm so sorry, but they carried the doctor off the train this morning so drunk he couldn't walk, and they laid him on the platform. And the station agent called me up, and I came down to get him. He's on the floor of his office here now. And I know he was trying so hard. I'm so sorry." Oh, they all felt so bad. And they went down. Bill and Ann went down and got him, brought him home, put him to bed. And the big experiment was over. Wednesday morning, I wake up. "Oh, my God, I'm so sick. I'm so sick." He said, "I'm so sorry. What day is today?" He said, "Wednesday, Bob." "Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I got to do a cancer surgery this morning. If I hung it out, they'll take my license, and I can't do the surgery with my hand. I can't. My God. But they got him up and bathed him and put his clothes on. Bill took him, got him a couple of drinks to steady his hand, dropped him off at the hospital. We'll be waiting for you, Bob. Okay. So they went home. He should be home about 12:30. 1, 2, 3, 4. Everybody knew where he was, out drunk again. And he came home, 6 o'clock, came in the door, just bubbling. Why? Where have you been, Bob? He said, "Why? When I was doing that surgery, I got thinking about the Oxford Group, and they want you to make amends, and I never thought a doctor should have to make amends. But I realized everybody's a human being, and I've been out making amends all day long, and I feel great." And, that was June 10th, 1935, which is the birthday of AA. And they decided, talking about spirits, hadn't worked for Bill in New York, didn't work for them there. They have to help somebody else. So they went to the hospital, found this goof up there. I heard him talk too. His name was Bill D. He was a lawyer from Louisville, who'd moved to Akron to get away from his troubles, which of course he didn't. And I heard him talk. He said, "I was laying in that bed in Akron, Ohio, and my wife said, 'There's two fellas who want to talk to you about your drinking.' And I said, 'I'm not going to talk to anybody about my drinking. I'm sick of talking to people about drinking. It's all they want to do is preach to me. But my wife's a very strong woman.' So I talked to them two fellas, and they never talked to me about my drinking once. They talked about their drinking and how they felt. And I never heard anybody describe me any better. I couldn't believe it. I was so impressed, I stuck with them fellas. I've been with them ever since. And little by little, in Akron, Ohio, they got drunkards to the Oxford Group. Most of them wouldn't want to come. Most of the guys that were working did come, but the ones that did come. I want to just mention one more thing, because it's always been a highlight in my memory. They finally got a young guy, Ernie, 29 years old. And they thought maybe he was too young to be an alcoholic. But maybe he wasn't. He seemed to be had problems. But they got him. They got him into the fold. But then he did something that all of us pay a terrible price for. He fell in love with Dr. Bob's daughter and brought our organization, new as it was, its first relationship. I know of no word that sends a shudder down a sponsor's spine worse than that word. "I want to talk to you about my new relationship." "Oh, shit. You want to have an aha machine on your desk?" "Okay, there. Uh-huh." But they really fell in love and they got married. And that sounds wonderful. It happened in my family. My youngest daughter, Susan, married the guy I sponsored. And I was against it, but the girls in the family outweighed me, of course. What do I know? I'm just an old father. I want to give you an absolute perfect example of mixed emotions. It's watching your daughter go down the aisle to marry a man whose fifth step you've heard. You can't really say anything, but you can give little hints. "Let me know if he ever brings a sheep home, honey." But anyway, I want to get off the subject, but anyway. They told him, "Now you're newlywed, you should stay home, and you don't have to do all the things we're doing, running around all these hospitals, everything. You stay home, take care of your new wife." So he did, and they all felt sad when he got drunk and died, and turned her against AA for 50 years. But little by little grew. But it's always grown by one method of somebody talking to somebody else and getting through that wall of difference and making them think, "I know how you feel a little bit." And at first, not much gets through. The guy says, "What was that you said?" Little by little. And it turns out that the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous is, and has always been, identification. That's the only thing that's different. They have nothing in our philosophy that's different. There's a thousand philosophies as good as ours on paper. But this one, because the problem is not so much our philosophy is so wonderful, but no philosophy works if you can't get to the guy. If it all bounces off the wall, no matter what it is. What we have is a way to get through that wall, and then we can implement the philosophy. And for the history of alcoholics, that's always been the story. When people begin to understand, my God, maybe you do know how I feel. Maybe I will do some of this dumb thing you told me to do, even though I disagree with it, little by little. And all the way down through the years. And we all know the story, of course, that Bill Wilson, 1941, they finally got this big article in the Saturday Evening Post, groups formed all over the country. And by 1942, there was more AIDS than I ever dreamed of. And by 1943, the groups were starting to die again. I get letters in New York all the time. Our group is dying. We don't know why. But people get arguing and fighting. And by 1944, didn't know what to do. Bill was desperate. He sounded the grapevine. He thought that would unify people. Big tabloid-sized magazine, and that didn't do it. In 1945, somebody wrote in an article for it and told him about the Oxford group, the Washingtonians, that big group that had been just a century before. Bill Wilson had never heard of it, never knew there had been another group of people. He went and got some books on it and realized how much they're similar, their patterns were to what AA was doing. That we could get him in, but we couldn't keep him here. And so he sat down using a Washingtonian experience, his own experience, and in a desperate effort to save AA, wrote the 12 Traditions, long after AA started. Many thousands had died in between. And in the long form, which most of us are familiar with, in the back of the book, in the opposite, there's a short form and a long form, which fleshes them out. And he issued them one by one in the grapevine. And unfortunately, Alcoholics Anonymous had a problem then, and it has now. We don't seem to get overcome it. It's full of alcoholics. And many people refuse it. We don't want any laws. We don't want any rules. We're here for love, goddammit. Don't give us rules. I want spirituality, you son of a bitch. And so a lot of people didn't accept him. He'd throw his wife in the sidecar, and he'd drive around New England and New York explaining to me about this. And it got to the point, God, it's kind of sad, in the archives of New York's letter I saw, it says, Bill, please come and talk at our meeting, at our anniversary, our second anniversary. We're so happy. Only if you promise not to talk about the traditions. We'd rather have you not come. I mean, that's really sad. And some people got involved in it, some didn't. They say, if we could only get these differing elements in one room together. Geez, the people from Los Angeles, the A group in Los Angeles, and the A group in Houston, the A group in Dallas, the A group in Chicago and New York and Akron and Miami. And so Bill and Dr. Bob, their followers didn't like each other at all. People in Akron thought New York was a bunch of city slickers, and the people in New York thought they were shit kickers. Nobody thought about it. You don't understand. But these two guys got along well. They assigned their people, please, let's have a meeting somewhere we can all talk. So they said, people actually said, okay, but we won't go to New York. The people in New York, not to be outdone in spirituality, said, we won't go to Akron. So Bill and Dr. Bob got together in 1950. They chose Cleveland. So in the summer of 1950, the first large group of sober alcoholics in America sitting down of our type ever. And I have the tapes of that convention. Your quality is pretty bad, but it's really interesting. And they had most of the people there were non-alcoholics. They had speaking because they were still desperately trying to have public people come in and see that they're not great, crazy people who are doing good. The warden of Sing Sing Sing, my warden of San Quentin, was there and spoke, and people from government. And Bill and Dr. Bob spoke. And Dr. Bob at that time, by now, was dying of cancer. So this rabbi said, you probably don't want to talk, Bob. You're so sick. He said, well, I got to talk. I'm next to Bill. I'm the sober the longest in the world. I've been sober 15 years. And so that afternoon, his son and another friend take this tall, gaunt, dying man to the podium. And he gave a talk. He was a great, great man. He had a great 12-stepper in his early days. And he started off, another talk. I want to welcome you all to Cleveland, and I hope you go back and tell the boys and girls in your group that we all get out of AA pretty much what we put into it. He said, I want to, as I look over this vast crowd, I'm pleased that some small thing I did 15 years ago in Akron helped bring this about. He said, I want to apologize for my health, that I haven't returned to my health as much. I've been in bed most of the past few months. I hope to get better soon. And just, you know, just gray talk. But then he said, I do think I would like to call your attention to two or three things. And then gave what many people consider to be the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. Short, 2 minutes, but in which he, almost like a deathbed admonition. He knew he was dying. He wanted so badly that people get involved. And what he said is as true today in Billings as it was that day in Cleveland, anywhere else. He said, first, let us remember to keep our program simple. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientific mind, but has nothing to do with our work here. Our work here, when reduced to the last, consists of love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And secondly, he said, let us guard that erring member, the tongue. Try to use it with kindness, understanding, and love. And there isn't a person in this room or any room like it who doesn't know exactly what he means. We're all wonderful when things are going our way. Hey, it's a beautiful place. It's full of love, doesn't it? But let somebody hurt our feelings or say something nasty about us or be unkind. And then I don't even think that son of a bitch is an alcoholic. Isn't that funny? To fight the term alcoholic our whole lives, then the worst thing you can say about somebody is to say they're not, you know. But brainwashing, I call it, brainwashing. And he said, finally, none of us would be here today if someone hadn't taken the time to maybe take us to a few meetings, to explain things to us, to give us a pat on the back if we needed it so badly. Let us never reach that stage of smug complacency where we are too busy to help our fellow who is still suffering in the pit of alcoholism. That's all. Thank you. And he sat down and was dead shortly thereafter. And what he said was just true. But the last thing he did there, they had six young guys. I didn't know who they were. I knew their first name, Jim, Art. But they each gave them two traditions in the long form to explain that, you know, these are not rules. These are, we have no way to enforce them even. You know, we can't, but we're not trying to save AA. You just hear their tails wagging. They're so excited, you know. And there was one mistake, you know, I thought. They said, AA doesn't have a police force. Some of us old timers think that was a mistake. You know, in my area, as unfair as it is, I have a reputation for being a dictator type sponsor. And no one ever seems to realize that to be a dictator-type sponsor, you must need the 100% cooperation of the dictatee. All he ever has to say is, screw you, and the dictatorship is over. I thought it would be nice if we could have people come at night and say, did you say screw you to your sponsor? Come with us to the camp for a few weeks. But anyway, they give all. But here's the interesting thing of all. You know, AA, the founders of AA and all the members are AA, dedicated spiritually, but still human beings. Human beings. Here, Bill Wilson, he wasn't sure if they could win the vote for the traditions. He said, you have heard the traditions read. Seeing no objections, they're accepted. Saved our life. But anyway, in the whole story of Alcoholics Anonymous, and in AA, our primary person carry the message who still suffers. Why not other people? Because the gift we've been given is trying to help someone identify that no one else, no doctor, no surgeon, no minister, no nothing can be able to do. And this identification is so important. That is why in the late 1950s, some couple guys I knew, one guy, Jim Willis, who had a bad gambling problem in addition to AA, and he'd bring his fellow gamblers, he was trying to help the AA, and they'd, I'm not a juicer, what the hell do I hear that shit for, you know? And he wrote to New York and became the first use of the 12 steps outside of AA, and he formed Gamblers Anonymous, which to this day is still the most successful of all of them. Everywhere you go in GA, there's Jim Willis's picture. And I knew him quite well, good man. He got so involved in the mid-50s that he was just busy in GA all over, setting up a big series of things for him. Never got back to AA much at all. So everybody got sad when he got drunk and died. But he hadn't outgrown his alcoholism. But he never gambled again, as they said. Then a couple years later, a couple guys at the North Hollywood Club, who I knew, wrote and got permission to use AA for form Narcotics Anonymous. Because they'd been taking their narcotics addicts to Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't identify. And that became the second one. Then a woman in the West End, I knew all these founders, all happened in Los Angeles. A woman founded Overeaters Anonymous. Then somebody else, a couple guys, founded Cocaine Anonymous. And those were the four major non-AA functioning things for people with problems of our type. And they have been doing well. I never really understood the difference. Where I got to understand the difference about identification, I think, when I was about 2 years sober. I was at the club one night. I still had no front teeth, but I was feeling good now. I gave a talk on obsessions. Not how to recover from them, I didn't know that, but I knew about the obsessions. I gave a great talk. And this rather plump lady came up after me and said, "So I'm the founder of a group called Overeaters Anonymous. We just started. We meet around the corner. I've never heard anybody talk about obsessions before. I think some of our ladies have got these. Could you come over Sunday and talk?" I said, "Sure." I was 130 pounds then, so scrawny. I have something to shoot for. Now we're there on Sunday and went in this room, about 8 kind of fat women sitting around a table. And I gave them a great talk on obsessions, helped them, I'm sure, create breakthroughs that saved all their lives. And I sat down, and they had a little sharing session, and I could not believe what I was hearing. Woman over here said she just had her son's 10th birthday. He was in military school in Long Beach. She sent her husband down to get him, and she prepared the cake for him, had it all ready. And she said, "I wonder if it's really a good cake." So she took a little taste, then a little more. By the time I got back, the cake was gone, and she felt so bad. And I didn't say anything, because I'm a nice guy. But I thought to myself, "Jesus Christ, just have a piece of cake and let it go with that. What the hell's wrong with you?" Over here, a woman says, "I eat ice cream. My husband's so angry, but I sneak out again. I just love ice cream. When I'm troubled, ice cream makes me feel better. Nothing makes me feel better than ice cream. I had a lot of it." And I didn't say anything. I'm a nice guy. I thought, no wonder you're fat, for Christ's sake. Anybody would be fat eating that much ice cream. But a woman over here was my favorite. She ate till she couldn't eat anymore. Then she put her finger down her throat and puked it up and ate some more. And I didn't say anything. Don't bother shaking hands with me after the meeting. I mean, I can see doing that for drinking, but not eating. I've done it for drinking a lot. Geez, Saturday afternoon, sun's still up, I'm drunk shit. Now, what was the difference? I understood it intellectually. My brain was sharper then than it is now. But I didn't identify. It was just information. Foreign information. To this day, when I go to an AA meeting, if somebody gets up there and gives a narcotic talk, some of them are very good, very slick, shooting up, sniffing up, and all this stuff. It's really interesting. I've been working with addicts for over 35 years. I probably know more about addiction than most addicts. And I find it interesting. But it doesn't touch me. What touches me is some goof getting up and saying, "Well, I got out of jail about 2 months ago and I came here. And Fred has been trying to help me, and I've got a little job now, and my folks are talking to me, and I'm glad to be here, thanks." That boom right in the old heart, boy. So that is why we ask that you be an alcoholic to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. We're not better or worse than addicts, not better or worse than gamblers, cocaine, nothing. What we have is the gift of being able to share with another person, hopefully, if they'll allow you, to get through and get them to start a new life. And without that, it's just information, and information has never helped alcoholics of our type ever, everywhere. They've been trying to work with people like us for 4,000 years with information, for a few years with identification. That's hard. I've talked a little too long on that subject. I told you more than you need to know, but I can see you're hungry for truth. This idea about the book, and you know, they say the book, we should update the book, and the book is, you know, it is a good book. I remember when I first came to AA in 1949, I was a young man, my sponsor gave me the book, and I read it, and I thought, this is really among the dullest books I've ever read, ever, and I didn't think any more about it. Some years later, I came off Skid Row, my new sponsor gave me a new book, and I read that. And much to my surprise, it was duller than I remembered. The book is really a dull book. I mean, they say it isn't badly written, it's just dull. And so I just had to give up on the book and allowed my sponsor to persecute me, and I got better. Then after a sober while, I looked at that book again, and, that wasn't in there before. You know, that book is rather strange. It gets smarter every year you're sober. Because we should change the book. But as though it were some novel or some history, and it isn't. What it is, when you really look at it, you've been sober a while, it's really a book of recipes. It's a cookbook for sobriety. It gives you recipes to follow. And because they deal with emotional recipes, of dealing with emotions, and you must do things that don't make sense to change those emotions. And there's stories in there, too, that helps you understand a little bit, gives you a little fill-in. But it really, the gist of it are the recipes. And these have been successful with human emotions where nothing else ever has for people like us. And, you know, it's true that sometimes the book you hear people say, this book is a miracle. Oh, Christ. You know, miracles are supposed to be something you can't explain. I heard a guy a few years ago said, I got up really early this morning. Looked at the eastern sky and the sun came up. And I said, it's a miracle. I've been given another day. And you said, oh, Jesus. Get up early tomorrow and have another one, you goof. Miracles are supposed to be things you can't explain, are inexplicable. What's inexplicable about this book? Well, it's this. This book in its present form was written by a guy who didn't know enough to write it, for one thing. He had no background in medicine, psychology. Most of the people he tried to help with were drunk after he had gotten to Washingtonians. You know, I mean, in the Oxford Group. Most unsuccess. The 12 stories in the back of the book, most of those guys drank again. Because they didn't know how to keep doing it. But, you know, he didn't know enough to write it. And he was 3 years sober. Now, some new guy says, oh, man, 3 years sober? Should know enough to write a book by then. When you get to be 3 years sober, you realize you don't know enough to write a book. By the time you're 5 years sober, you just try to be nice to people 3 years sober. Hang in there, Jimmy, you're doing a good job. By the time you're 10 years sober, you hate to send people 3 years sober to get your coffee. Was that one cream and two sugars? Never mind, I'll do it myself. By the time you're 20 years sober, you hate to have people 3 years sober unattended on your property. And this guy, 3 years sober, wrote a book that has changed more alcoholic lives of our nature in the last 68 years than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. That is a miracle. That is a miracle. And people come to AA and after 2 or 3 months want to change that. I don't think we should do it that way. Hey, we should. And you just, oh, don't you? Oh. And why don't you Why don't you write a version of the way you think it should be, and we'll all read it together? Let's see how it works for other people first. Find us a few people that are staying sober on your new book. And this came up at the international get-together in New York with the delegates, and they talked about it for 2 days. And thank God they finally voted down changing the first 164 pages. They changed the stories, and they put a new cover on it. We all know this. But thank God that 164 pages is inviolate, because I don't know what it is in there exactly that saved my life, but something in there did, and a lot of it did. I read it today to remind myself how to keep staying sober. So I think the idea of changing the book is just a little bit premature. If you know somebody who wants to change the book, let's show us your version and let's try it out for you. Try it out for a year and see how it works. Then come back and we'll talk about it. I'm not going to risk my life for some little snot who doesn't know, perpetually dissatisfied with life. I'm not judging them. Of course, the third thing is the idea of medications. And people say, don't play doctor. But I'll tell you something. It's hard to remember this, because it's hard today because a lot of people are on medications. A lot of people in AA and many parts of the country are loaded constantly. And one of the problems, of course, is that most treatment centers today load them up with these new strong antidepressants, and they come out of their cured, apparently. They're not, but they don't know it. And the trouble, antidepressants are fine, I guess. They stop the depression. I was put in the insane asylum in Texas as a suicidal depressive. And I got out of there, and they gave me a Thorazine for a long time. And I never even drank, but I took my Thorazine and just kind of stood around a lot. Thank God I ran out of that crap one day and had a little drink. Or a big drink. Several big drinks. But the concept... The bad thing about this is, and I think it'd be dangerous to go up to people who are on psychotropic drugs who really have mental illnesses. And say, I would never do that. But when people come to me, or when I see people on those drugs, I say, I'll tell you what, if you're on antidepressants, or things of that nature, or the Haldols and stuff like that, I would like to help you withdraw from it. I'll work with your doctor, and we'll see if we can wean you off little by little. Because they're so strong now, you can't just quit. I mean, some people can, but... You go crazy. And to little by little, I've done this with a few people. Other people say, I'm not going to do that. And I say, well, I can't be your sponsor then because I have no background in successful medication of drunks. The point is, not that I'm against antidepressants, but they are today so strong that they become addictive in themselves, and they're designed, any doctor will tell you, they're designed for short-term use, and you take them as suggested, and you're all right. But people like us don't take things as suggested. We take them as long as I think I need them, which is till next St. Swithin's Day, just on and on. And they get addicted, and after a while, you ought to read the medical reports, long-term results of antidepressants, suicide, terrible depressions, sometimes homicide. You'll see it in paper every so often. And it's so threatening. And I wouldn't tell people to stop taking drugs. But I would say, here's what happens. And let's try to see if we can get... Now, I sponsor a couple of people who are really mentally ill. And I've gone to talk to their doctors. And I experimented with one, getting them off. And they got so crazy, I said, get back on. Because some crazy people really need it. But they're very rare. Now, what the big epidemic in America today is bipolarism. It's the worst epidemic. No epidemic's ever spread so fast as bipolarism through Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm bipolar. And I have ups and downs and I can't deal with them. I remember talking to Dr. Paul Holliger, who's dead now, but he's a good AA member, and he had death on medications. He said, you can't blame the doctors. He said, what is bipolarism? That's another nice name for the old thing called manic depressive. What is the symptoms of manic depression? Highs and lows. Highs and lows. What's the symptoms of bipolarism? Highs and lows. Highs and lows. What's the symptoms of early sobriety? Highs and lows. Highs and lows. And the doctor's sitting there talking to somebody. Well, I have these highs and lows, doctor. He's got a room full of people who are really sick. Here, take these and keep in touch. Yeah. And I, as I say, in my group, nothing in ACE says you have to do this, but we are, and I think in your group probably, we look with disfavor upon people who are loaded on medications, unless they have some reason to stabilize. But because it doesn't mean to say we're here to get off alcohol is ridiculous. That would mean you could just jump into cocaine and jump into heroin and whatever you want. We are here to learn to live in reality. That's what AA is about. And if we can do that for people, help them learn to live in reality, not sedated reality, but reality. And each of us, when we're feeling bad, think my case is different. I need it. They don't. I do. And you got to find a way to overcome that. But I think that's the... In my opinion, I'm not playing doctor. I'm just telling you that if you keep taking these, you're going to be awfully sorry. But if you want to take them, adios. The next thing, this fight against the Lord's Prayer. You don't hear about it here because, you know, the last time I listened to it, everybody said it jolly. We did my group, you know, a lot of places. But they say it's too Christian a prayer. It's too religious. We shouldn't use it. And it's just terrible. And people, how in the hell do we ever get to say the Lord's Prayer anyway? By one of the strangest coincidences you'll ever know, I happen to have the reason in my pocket. You think this is spooky, huh? This is a letter Bill Wilson wrote in 1959 to explain why we say the Lord's Prayer. Now about the business of adding the Lord's Prayer to each AA meeting. This practice probably came from the Oxford groups who were influential in the early days of AA. You have probably noted in AA Comes of Age what the connection of these people with AA really was. I think saying the Lord's Prayer was a custom of theirs following the close of each meeting. Therefore, it quite easily got shifted into general use among us. Of course, there are always those who seem to be offended by the introduction of any prayer whatever into an ordinary AA meeting. Also, it is somewhat complained that the Lord's Prayer is a Christian document. Nevertheless, this prayer is of such widespread use and recognition that the argument of its Christian origin seems to be a little far-fetched. It is also true that AAs believe in some kind of God, and that communication and strength is obtainable through His grace. Since this is the general consensus, it only seems right that at least the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer be used in connection with our meetings. It does not seem necessary to defer to the feelings of our agnostic and atheist newcomers to the extent of completely hiding our light under a bushel. However, around here, the leader of the meeting usually asks those to join him in the Lord's Prayer who feel they would care to do so. The worst that happens to the objectors is that they have to listen to it. This is doubtless a salutary exercise in tolerance at their stage of progress. Now, they're talking about the Serenity Prayer, this non-religious prayer. This is the Serenity Prayer. If some of you know where it was written by a Christian theologian in 1935, printed in a Christian magazine, and somebody in the Oxford group noticed it and clipped it out, 1935. And they gave it to Bill Wilson, and he liked it. But here's the Serenity Prayer, as written. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting the hardship as the pathway to peace, taking as Jesus did this sinful world as it is, not as I would have it, trusting that Jesus will make all things right is surrender to His will. That I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with Him forever in the next. Amen. Now that's what I call a religious prayer. But it isn't a religious prayer as far as we're concerned because we take part of it. But there's nothing in the Lord's Prayer, there's nothing in the Lord's Prayer that I can think of that's not in the 12 steps, one form or another. And these people, They're just people who come to A and want to find things to screw up, carp about, and whine about. I know that when I go to meetings where they don't say the Lord's Prayer, there's one person in that room saying the Lord's Prayer. I say it, to hell with them. I'm a little out of sync. I say it loudly so the people on either side of me can hear it too. That's my path, but it's not easy being a missionary. If you hear any people tell you not to, the Lord's Prayer is too Christian, that's baloney. It's been used by everybody in the world. My home group meets in a synagogue, you know that, in Los Angeles. Some of you don't know it. Big synagogue, big Jewish synagogue. Wednesday night, 1,000 people in the meeting, all up and ready to go. Some of you have been there. Once in a while, I see the rabbi come in the back, sit in the back row, wondering, how can I get this many people in here on Friday? But if we get up and say the Lord's Prayer, he gets up and says the Lord's Prayer. It doesn't affect a rabbi, but it affects some little snot who hasn't been to a synagogue in 5 years. That hurts his feelings. Screw him. Take that off the tape, will you? I don't want people to think I'm not spiritually perfect. The last thing I want to discuss briefly is this idea of anonymity. Why should we remain anonymous? That's so silly. Having to hide our light, hide around as though. In the first place, there's some new people here. I want to explain what anonymity is. Because of the nature of my work and what I do, I get my name in the paper a lot and my picture. I'm on television sometimes, and I get an article about me in the Reader's Digest. And in each case, I'm known as a recovered alcoholic. People say, you broke your anonymity. No, I didn't. I didn't break my anonymity at all. That's what I am. I'm a recovering alcoholic. It is when I say I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's when I break my anonymity. When I just say I'm just a guy, there's nothing there. But once AA gets involved, then there's no face, there's no name, no last name. Did you ever see that program on television in 2000 where they did the hour-long A&E thing on AA? They've had four spokesmen from around the country. I was a spokesman in Los Angeles. Perhaps now you recognize me. But that's what anonymity is. And the reason for anonymity, I suppose, maybe in 1937 or 38 when AA really got going, in 1945, when he wrote the traditions, anonymity was perhaps still somewhat important as a protector. I remember when I got introduced to anonymity. When I was first sober, there was a woman in AA who wrote a book called I'll Cry Tomorrow. Her name was Lillian Roth, very famous singer at that time. And her sponsor said, now you're in AA, now don't mention AA in your book. She said, when people know that Lillian Roth is in AA, they'll want to come. So she had a long two paragraphs on what AA did for her and how much she did it. And a couple years later, when she was laying drunk, face down in Palm Springs, vomiting up her pills and booze, I don't think anybody thought negatively against AA, but kind of killed her. Then the next year, John Barrymore's daughter, a woman named Diane Barrymore, she wrote a book called Too Much Too Soon. And she took it a step further. She'd been helped so much by AA that she could have wine with dinner. I remember reading that thing, But then a couple years after that, she died in a cell out in Malibu, dead drunk and smashing her head into the wall. I don't suppose anybody thought much about that. I have never seen anybody who breaks their anonymity who profits from it. And a number of people have. 1972, one of the presidential candidates admitted he was in AA when his campaign was going bad. And that made it go even worse, and he never was the same afterwards. Now, why would that be? I can't believe that God is sitting there, oh, you broke your anonymity, I'm going to screw up your life. I don't think it's going to happen. I think it boils down to, it's more of a spiritual thing, that when I surrender my ego, as it were, to Alcoholics Anonymous, I've got a covering over me of 2.5 million people. When I say, I'm going to help AA, I change the relationship. I'm now above AA, helping these little people, and I don't need them anymore because they've. And from then on, you're all by yourself. It's a lonely thing being above AA, I'll tell you. So to me, anonymity is still a great thing. I know when Bill Wilson died, the last letter he wrote was dealing with the spiritual concept of anonymity. It's not a protection, it's a spiritual concept for us to diminish our egos as much as we can to live in a world around us. And that has always been the great goal of Alcoholics Anonymous, to live in some kind of peace. You know, and some, you can argue all these things I talked about today, because there's arguments going on all over. I hear some of them in England, some of them, heard one of them in Bali last year. People down there can't find their ass, but they know more about AA than anybody else, you know, just things like that. Probably the greatest reason to do the things the way we do, I think, to me, it scares me to think changing AA. For one reason, now I have three daughters, 18 years old, 18 years sober in AA. They got sober in the same kind of AA I did. Not around me, but somewhere else. I have two grandsons. One grandson has got a year sober. I have two great-grandsons. One of them is either a potential alcoholic or the spawn of the devil. I can't make out. I look at the back of his neck to see there's a 666 there. But when that little crap head grows up and comes through that door, I sure want him to hear what I heard and have sponsors talk to him about the things I heard about and take the actions I took, not to give some psychologist or some goofy religious nonsense that will just give him information that will make him die. That's why we want to keep it the way it is. And the reason we do these things, I suppose, to sum it up, and I've talked a long time, but to sum it up, it's the end of the 12 traditions in the long form. If you haven't read them, you ought to read them, because in our group, we read them every month, because they really fill out, tell you why we're doing what we're doing. But the last phrase of that is such a good thing, because it talks about what we have. Why are we doing these things? And it says, this to the end, that our great blessings shall never spoil us, that we shall forever live in thankful contemplation of Him who presides over us all. Thank you.